we pass legislation that transfers money from the young and the poor to the old and the rich, whether it's our tax policy, our social policy. An average 7-year-old is 72% wealthier than they were 40 years ago. The average person under the age of 40 is 24% less wealthy. And what we have in the quote unquote most prosperous economy in the world is a generation of youth that is less well off financially, more anxious, more depressed, more obese, more likely to be addicted to opiates. What they see is the prosperity my generation enjoyed, and they're not getting theirs. Mm-hmm. And they're reminded by it by Mark Zuckerberg every 3 seconds.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to a special in-studio episode of The Julia LaRoche Show, where we are joined by Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern, a best-selling author and author of the brand new book, The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security. Scott, it's great to see you in person, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your fifth book, I believe.
Fifth book, yeah.
All right. Well, that's awesome. I loved the book. I finished it before we did this. And
wow.
I'd like to start where I always start with my guest, and that is to, you know, get their big picture assessment of the economy, where we are today. Let's start there before we dive into the book.
The honest answer about the, So if anything can convince you that nobody knows, it's this economy, because I think your old employer, you were at Bloomberg, right?
I was a Business Insider and Yahoo Finance.
Okay, got it. Bloomberg does an audit of economists around projections for the coming year. The first time they've had any issue where the economists were all unanimous in their viewpoint was that in 2022, they all agreed that we were going into some form of a recession in 23. That did not happen. Nobody saw a record acceleration in interest rates and mortgages to go from 2.5% to 7.5% and that housing prices would explode. That just usually doesn't happen. So the reality is, and this is part of the book, nobody knows. That's my general assessment of the economy. So you want to be invested, you want to be diversified, and you don't want to fall into the trap of believing that you can predict the economy in cycles, because it's just one of the wonderful things about the markets is, in fact, nobody knows and it can behave irrationally. The bigger picture, America is a remarkable economy right now. Strongest GDP growth in the G7, lowest inflation, record job growth. I mean, it's not distributed. What William Gibson said about the future, it could be said about our prosperity right now, and that it is not, it's not distributed equally, but prosperity is here. There are few nations that wouldn't kill to have our economy right now. You know, for all the talk about China becoming the biggest economy in the world, in the last 3 years, they've shed $6 trillion in market cap from their stock market. We've had just seven companies add $3 or $4 trillion in the last 4 months. So it's, if you don't like our economy, it's the least bad in the world right now.
Yeah. Okay. So the last time I had you on would have been late 2022. You had your book Adrift, America in 100 Different Charts. And we did talk about the economic picture there. Has your assessment, it sounds a bit more upbeat than it was back then. Has it changed at all, like the broader picture of the economy?
On a meta basis, the American economy is doing really well. I would argue the ground zero for what is the problems that ail our economy, or ail our, it's not our economy, our society, is that the prosperity is not evenly distributed. That for the first time in our nation's history, a 30-year-old is not doing as well as his or her parents were at 30. That's never happened before. That's the fundamental breakdown in the social compact we have, that if you play by the rules, you're a good person, you get some luck, your kids will do better than you. And when that doesn't happen, it creates rage and shame, not only among the parents, but among the kids themselves, that, oh, by the way, every day I'm reminded that if they don't have a hot boyfriend, a six-pack, haven't made millions of dollars trading NVIDIA or Dogecoin, and aren't killing it at Google, and aren't vacationing at the Amangiri in Utah, that somehow they have failed. So we have an economy that is not, we've decided, my generation has decided not to share the spoils. And we, the incumbents throw up their arms and say, oh, it's because of network effects or globalization. Bullshit. Every day, we pass legislation that transfers money from the young and the poor to the old and the rich. Whether it's our tax policy, our social policy, we have decided that the key is to keep Scott rich, even if it means keeping minimum wage at $9.25 an hour, stripping out the child tax credit so we can have a $135 billion increase in Social Security living adjustment. An average 7-year-old is 72% wealthier than they were 40 years ago. The average person under the age of 40 is 24% less wealthy. And what we have in the quote-unquote most prosperous economy in the world is a generation of youth that is less well-off financially, more anxious, more depressed, more obese, more likely to be addicted to opiates, and generally feels shitty about America. People my generation, 55%, feel proud to be American. It's 18% among people under the age of 25 because what they see is the prosperity my generation enjoyed, and they're not getting theirs, mm-hmm. and they're reminded by it by Mark Zuckerberg every 3 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah, and all the wealth porn, you called it wealth porn in the book that they're seeing on social media and everyone's acting like they're a baller and whatnot. So the algebra of wealth.
Yeah.
There are so many like personal finance books. I know this is not like the Susie Orman, yeah. Dave Ramsey type of book.
Yeah.
What was it that made you want to write this particular book, the focus on, you know, I guess like building wealth? Is it for that younger version of you, or is it for the younger, like what we're saying, this younger generation right now kind of feels a little bit left out?
Well, it's for anyone who has, you know, at least 20 years to kind of build wealth. So that means if you're over the age of 70, this book isn't for you. Because the reality is most people, a lot of people call me and say, I'm in my 40s, it's too late. That probably means you're going to live another 50 years. You have some catching up to do. You have a little bit more saving to do. You got to be a little bit more focused. You got to be a little bit more sober about your spending. But you can build wealth, you know, you can still, at 42, I was pretty much broke. And I go back and I look at what led to that, what behaviors led to me making so much money in my 20s and 30s and yet ending up broke at 42 or near broke. And you know that study that says you are the average of your 5 closest friends? You become the same body mass index, same politics, same jobs, same salary. That is true. It's weird how we kind of regress to the mean of our 5 closest friends. What has greater variance, though, is even if they're making approximately the same money, one of those people will end up much better well off economically than the other 4. And so I try to understand, what are the behaviors and strategies of people who make the same amount of money as their friends, but end up much more financially secure? And it distills down to a few basic things. The first is focusing on your talent, not following your passion. Your 20s are about finding something you're really good at. And then the promise I can make to you is that mastery of something that provides economic security for you and your family will make you passionate about whatever it is. Frustrates me when commencement speakers say, follow your passion. If someone tells you to follow your passion, it means they're already rich. Mm-hmm. And the person telling you to follow your passion made their billions in iron ore smelting. And what I would suggest is that find something you're good at and can become great at in an industry, and this is key, that has a 90%+ employment rate. So just recognize if you want to be an athlete, a music star, a model in restaurants, that you need validation pretty early that you're in the top 1%. Because if you're not, you're not going to be able to make a living. The SAG-AFTRA union members are the most talented people in Hollywood. These are the cream of the cream, right? 180,000. 87% of them don't qualify for health insurance because they don't make more than $23,000 a year. Whereas you can just be in the top half of accounting, the top half of plumbing, of electric. You know, find something you could be great at that has a 90%+ employment rate, because being great at something in the economic accoutrements, the relevance, the camaraderie, the prestige will make you passionate about whatever it is. Second thing, try and live a little bit like a stoic, establish a savings muscle, even if it's only 100 or 200 bucks a month when you're younger. Building the muscle that you know how to spend less than you make really pays off in your 30s and 40s when hopefully you're making some money through that focus and you can really start saving. Also, understand the flaw in the species is that because we haven't lived much longer than 35, the human brain literally can't wrap its head around the fact that you're going to be here another 50 or 60 years and it's going to go really fast. Mm-hmm. And then just a little bit of saving early on, low-cost diversified index funds, it adds up to so much over time. And to recognize that time will go really fast. And then finally, diversification. You don't need to be a hero. Don't try and find the needle in the haystack. Buy the whole haystack. And this is where I really screwed up. I always went all in on one investment or one company thinking there's no way this isn't going to be huge. Borrow money to buy more of the stock in the company that I started that was going public, right? Always doubling down. And there's great stories about Mark Zuckerberg turning down offers. Assume you are not Mark Zuckerberg. And as soon as you can start diversifying, the way I describe it is it's your Kevlar. You can take a bullet to the chest. You can have a stock go to zero. And if you've diversified, it hurts, but it doesn't kill you. It's not fatal. Diversification.
Yeah, that's the formula. Focus plus stoicism times time, and times diversification. You mentioned almost going broke at age 42.
Yep.
Was that around like the dot-com bubble, the financial crisis? Can you take us back to that time in your life? Because most folks might assume looking at you like, wow, like you probably just, it was a linear path up for you, but it wasn't. So take us back to that time.
I don't know a successful person that's had a linear path. I mean, it's just, that's what people think success looks like. Mm-hmm. It looks more like a roller coaster. I went broke twice. Got out of business school, really fast start. Right at 26, I started a firm called Profit. I sold it for $33 million by the time I was in my early 30s. So I thought I was rich. But divorce and the dot-com explosion both took me pretty much to zero, or dot-com implosion. Then I worked my way back. Then 2008 hit. I was very into tech stocks. Amazon. People remember Amazon went to $6 a share. Apple was at $8 a share. Netflix was at $10 a share in 2009. And so that took me way down. And those were lessons that I should have been more diversified. It would have been much easier for me. It would have been much better on my mental health not to be on this roller coaster, to diversify, to have taken a little bit of money off the table and put it into low-cost index funds. But what I was able to do, and start employing these practices, but what's unfair is that in 2009, we let the economy crash, which is important, churn is important, and I got to buy those stocks at low numbers. You know, I bought Apple at $8 a share because I was coming into my prime income earning years, always investing, diversifying. And then since then, quite frankly, my wealth has just exploded. And it's because of a few things. One, I work hard, I'm talented, but I started spending a lot less than I was making so I could save. I diversified. And also, the observation I would make is that wealth is a full person project. That there's this myth of really wealthy people being Monty Burns, who are isolated people lighting their cigars with $100 bills, who aren't good people. I have generally found, and there's research here, that people who establish economic security are put in rooms of opportunity even when they're not there, that they're high character people, that people want to win. And the way to snatch financial defeat from the jaws of economic security is divorce personally. You lose 60% of your assets overnight, 50% of your wealth, and then another 10% because your costs go up, if not more because you're a forced seller. But also what we don't talk about is professional divorce. You know, the thing that kills small companies that are doing well, or even medium-sized companies, is the partners go at each other. They get into a fight and it tears apart the firm. So professional divorce. So if you're making a good living and you want to be sure that you ideally have a greater chance of building real wealth, you want to bring forgiveness and generosity to your personal and your professional relationships. And I generally find that people who have economic security are good people who've been able to maintain strong relationships. You know, the key is not waiting for an apology, but getting to the point where you can forgive the debt. Like, if you don't bring forgiveness to relationships, if you don't bring generosity, I don't think you're ever going to be that financially successful, because the key to wealth and greatness is in the agency of others. And that is, you want people, you want to collect allies along the way.
Yeah. You talk a lot about relationships in the book, and I would love to hear like the importance of maybe family in that relationship, because I feel like, I believe like the birth of your son was also a catalyst for you, wasn't it? Take us back to that time in your life too. And I've interviewed other folks who have had a similar thing when they had a kid come into their lives.
Yeah, well, it just got me very focused. My goals as a young man were to be rich and awesome. And not as much to be those things, but to have the appearance of those things. So I was spending pretty much, not every dollar I made, I was never in debt or anything like that, but I was just focused on perception. So it was important to me to be seen at the right clubs, go to St. Bart's over the holidays, have a very expensive car, have the fat loft in Soho. And when the kid came along and I didn't have as much money as I thought, it was really upsetting and humiliating. If I'd just been a little bit smarter, a little bit more mature, had invested early, I would have just been in a less insecure position. So the kid got me, or kids now, very focused. It's no longer about you and there's no faking it. I'm a talented guy. If I was single, I can crash on people's couch. I know I can make a living. When it's your kid, you can't do that. You got to have good schools. You got to have a certain level of economic security. So having a kid really got me focused. For the first time in my life, it was just not all about me, and I wasn't used to that. But what I would say is that I'm writing this book on masculinity. I think it's a good starting place for every man to assume they're going to be responsible for the economic livelihood of the house. And sometimes that means getting out of the way and being more supportive of your partner who's better at this whole money thing. There's more female college grads. So some of that sometimes is just being really supportive. But I don't think it's a bad place to start to say, I'm going to be responsible for the economic well-being of this household. That requires discipline. It requires maturity. And I want to be clear, it comes with a trade-off. I didn't see a lot of my kids when they were young. I decided that economic security was going to be really important, and I'm not talented enough to do it on 40 hours a week. I had to work 60 to 80, and it comes at a cost. I hate the myth of balance. You can have it all, but you can't have it all at once. And if I wanted to stay in New York and provide the life for myself and my family that I aspired to, I knew I was just going to have to work really hard. And it comes at a cost, and you need a good partner. You got to be on the same page with your partner around the requisite trade-off and commitment. But, you know, those were really stressful, hard years where I didn't get a chance to spend a lot of time with my kids. I have a lot of balance now, Julia, because I didn't have much then. So I'm not talking about the way the world should be. I'm talking about the way the world is. And if you aspire to live in New York and have several kids or in any high-cost city, you're going to have to make a lot of money. And what I have found is the only route to a lot of money involves luck. It involves generosity, talent, and trade-offs. I don't think there's a free lunch here.
Hey there, I hope that you are enjoying this interview. If you can, please take a moment to hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and ring the notification bell. This will keep you up to date with all of our new interviews, and it will also help us grow this channel and continue to bring some amazing guests. Thank you so much for your support, and enjoy the rest of the interview.
I like that. It's not, and the book is not about what the world should be. It is about what it is. I also liked this line. The ultimate objective is to enjoy a life rich in relationships, not die with the biggest number in the bank. You were just mentioning like your own children, and you tell a story in the book about your son lost a glove while you were on a ski trip. But then you go back in time to a moment when you lost a jacket, not just once, but twice. Can you take us back to your childhood and your relationship with money back then?
Well, I grew up we were upper lower middle class. My household, I was raised by a single immigrant brother who lived and died a secretary a lot of my life. We never had, I think we peaked, our household income peaked at $40,000. And it wasn't like we had a bad life. We could still take vacations. You know, we had a decent home. But when you're raised in a family, especially with one parent where you don't have money, you have kind of this ghost following you around everywhere, whispering in your ear that you're not worthy, that, oh, you're not like other people, like you screwed up, you don't have money. And it does attack your self-esteem. It also just creates dramatic stress. Kids from low-income households have higher standing blood pressure. It affects everybody. And the story you're referencing is, I just remember, I lose everything. I'm 5 minutes away from losing my keys. I've given up on the concept of keys. I can no longer own keys. So when I was a kid, I was the same way. And I lost a jacket. My mom, we had to go get another one. Jackets were $32 from JCPenney's. That cost a lot. And then I lost a second one. I just remember being at home, like just freaked out that I was going to have to tell my mom I'd lost another jacket. And the thing with my son losing a glove and him being so upset and crying because gloves cost 30 euros. We were in Europe at the time. And that kind of rattled me. It took me back to an ugly place. And I'm very motivated on financial security. I think America becomes more like itself every day. It's a rapacious, violent place for people without money. It's a loving, generous place for people with money. So, you know, I've always started boring businesses, analytics companies, strategy consulting firms. But here's the thing. I just love being able to take care of my kids. I can take care of my father really well right now. I was able to give my mom a really nice life at the end. Those were like amazing things. I get to do incredible things now because of some of the trade-offs and sacrifices I made around my lifestyle early in life. So, yeah, my childhood absolutely was tremendously, informing and motivating. And the thing I worry about, I know you have a family, how do I instill that level of hunger and grit in my kids? Because what I often say, and I don't have the answer here, is that if I had what my kids have, I wouldn't have what I have. I was willing to work really hard because I thought, I'm just not going back. I'm not going back to that insecure kind of unloving place. But it's a story of really, in some ways, I don't want it to be a sob story, it's a story of how much America loved me and my mom. When my mom was unemployed, she got unemployment insurance. I got Pell Grants. I'm a white, straight male, and I got unfair advantage through financial aid because I came from a household that was low income, and it lifted me up. And I got access to the University of California, Los Angeles. It had a 76% admissions rate when I applied. It's now 9%. And then I got a 2.27 GPA, true story. And Berkeley, the finest public institution in the world, let me in for graduate school. And people say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Well, guess what? Higher ed is supposed to help the unremarkable kids have a shot at being remarkable. And unfortunately, they've morphed into these luxury brands where they take pride on rejecting people and trying to identify a super class of remarkably, freakishly remarkable kids or rich kids who they're going to turn into a billionaires. And I think that's entirely not what America is about. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about and getting involved in programs to try and expand freshman class size, more vocational programs. But, you know, I'm here because of the generosity of the University of California and its taxpayers, the irrational passion for my well-being and my mother. And what I would say, America used to love unremarkable kids. And I worry that America is falling out of love with unremarkable kids. So I think we're turning into something that's not very American.
What do you think is driving that?
Selfishness among people my generation who make excuses for why, you know, one in five kids should be in poverty, make excuses to increase the cost of living adjustment and Social Security, $135 billion a year. $35 billion tax credit for children gets ripped out of the infrastructure bill, but the $135 billion a year increase in Social Security flies through. We have minority rule. Our leadership in Washington is a cross between the Golden Girls and the Walking Dead. And what do you know? Seniors continue to do really well, and young people don't. Young people don't vote. Kids don't vote. And Washington has been weaponized by people like me. Once you get really rich, your taxes go down. So minimum wage is $9.25. If it had just kept up with inflation or productivity, it'd be at $23 a share. The two biggest tax deductions are mortgage tax interest and capital gains. Who owns homes and makes their money from selling stocks? People my age with my wealth. Who makes money with sweat? Who rents? Young people. Everything we do on a big scale is nothing but an economic transfer from the young and the poor to the old and the rich. The biggest theft in history, economic theft, was the CARES Act, COVID. We took $7 trillion under the auspices of COVID and we flushed it into the economy. 85% of it wasn't spent. People didn't spend it on food or hospital. 85% was saved, which meant it went into the market, which sent housing prices and stocks skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. You think, well, that's a good thing. No, it's not. It's good if you're like me and you own a home and you own stocks. If you're trying to buy a home or you don't have your stocks yet, it just means everything's crazy expensive. And the reason why I am wealthy is because we bailed out the banks in 08, but we didn't bail out the economy. And as I was coming into my prime income earning years, I was able to buy Netflix at, no joke, $12 a share. It's at 600 now. Where does a young person find churn and disruption and opportunity? When you bail out the baby boomer owner of a restaurant, all you're doing is robbing opportunity from the 26-year-old recent grad of a culinary academy that wants her shot. These guys, these young guys, they should be able to rent office space. You know, during COVID, they should have had the opportunity to buy all the shit in this place for 30 cents on the dollar as some boomer hits hard times. We need disruption. We need churn. And what we decided with COVID is that a million people dying would be bad. But what would be tragic is if baby boomers lost any of their wealth. So we've done away with the ordinary cycles to recalibrate economic opportunity to ensure that the incumbents stay rich. And it's enraging young people. I think a lot of our social problems, which are justifiable, but these kids get so, they go from zero to rage so fast because, boss, you got yours, where's mine? Mm-hmm. And every day I'm reminded that I'm failing. So I think my generation has been especially greedy. My tax rate over the last 10 years has been 17%. Does that make any sense? Literally, why? Because I'm wealthy and I can own things. We've decided that the money makes is more noble than the money sweat makes. So I buy a stock, I hold on to it, I sell it, I get taxed at 23.8 plus all sorts of tax incentives that can be jammed in there. You know, the kids running this pod thing, if they make a decent living in New York, they're going to pay 40% tax rates. So these are intentional decisions The incumbents will throw up their arms. They don't issue housing permits. Once you own a home, you become very concerned with traffic and you show up at the local review board and you make it really hard to build houses, right? Once you have your college degree, you applaud the dean for rejecting more and more people. Oh, that makes me feel good about myself. Well, spoiler alert, all the people who say with glee and pride, I could never get into my college now. Well, guess what? That means your daughter's not getting in.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's like, I remember one of my last conversations before lockdowns was with you on set at Yahoo Finance. And we were talking about this could be an opportunity for my generation to buy in. And I'm also kind of, this is terrible, but I kind of like want a recession so I can buy a house at a decent price versus the inflated prices right now. But yeah, it's crazy.
But that's a key point. There's two stages in your career economically, your life. There's when you're investing and then when you're harvesting. When you're making money, hopefully you have discipline, a good partner, and you make more than you spend. You're investing. You're buying a home. You're starting to buy stocks. When you're investing, you want asset prices to be as low as possible. It's when you're harvesting that you want them to be high. So the harvesters, i.e. old people already rich, have made sure that asset prices stay high. We can't build enough houses because we've made permits really hard to get. So who does that hurt? The people who want to enter. From 2019 to 2023, the average house went from $290,000 to $410,000, and interest rates went from 3% to 7%. So the average mortgage rate has gone from $1,100 to $2,200. Two-thirds of America used to be able to afford a home. Now it's one-third. Who is that great for? The people that already own fat homes, yep. i.e. yours truly. Who is it terrible for? People trying to buy a goddamn home. And it's artificial scarcity. It's weaponizing housing permits. It's weaponizing. And who paid? Who's going to have to pay back the $7, $10, $12 trillion in debt we have used to artificially inflate prices to keep me wealthy? You and these kids and our kids through debt. So let me borrow your credit card so I can stay rich and upgrade from Carnival to Crystal Cruises. And you just got to figure your own shit back. We are not investing in future generations. And it augurs the question. I just spoke at TED and the title of my talk was, do we love our children? We love our kids. But if you look at economic policy, it appears that we've kind of declared war on the young, that we see them as nutrition, not the future. It used to be we'd spent $3 on seniors for every one we spent on kids, which in itself is outrageous. That was 1990. Guess what it is today? We spend $8 on seniors for every one we spend on kids. So, okay, what's our priority? I'm not saying we should have homeless seniors, but the greatest wealth transfer in history happens every year where we have young people transfer $1.5 trillion to the wealthiest generation in the history of the planet, seniors.
Let me ask you this, because you mentioned earlier universities. They're a luxury brand now.
Yep.
And this is something you've been talking about for a few years. I want to get your take on what's happening on university campuses, yep. Ivy Leagues, what's going on at Columbia University right yep. now. I imagine you have a point of view. What is your take on what is going on these campuses?
There's so much there, Julia. So first off, I'm glad a camera wasn't following me around when I was 19. I have a lot of sympathy for a 19-year-old, whether you agree with them or not, to have a pretty wide berth, to say and do stupid things and be forgiving. And also, I think free speech is important. I think if someone is on campus, they should pretty much be able to say anything about anybody they want, as long as it's peaceful and as long as it doesn't cross into hate speech. Hate speech where an interest group feels threatened, physically harassed, unsafe. And I think that line has been crossed too many times on campus, where the faculty and administration have not drawn a sharper relief between free speech and hate speech. If you want to come to NYU and have a protest and be pro-Palestine, that have at it. Be thoughtful, be considerate. Don't make anyone feel unsafe. Say whatever you want. It feels like we've crossed the line on a few of these campuses where Jewish kids don't feel safe. And the other thing I find upsetting is I feel that, I'll give an example. I'm in the faculty at NYU. I think if I went into the square with a Confederate flag and a white hood and started saying with a megaphone, lynch the blacks or burn the gays, I'm fairly certain my NYU ID would be turned off by close of business. I'd be kicked off the faculty and I would never work in academia again. But when there are protests and hate speech against Jews, we start hearing words like nuance and First Amendment and free speech. So I'm comfortable with a line. What I'm not comfortable with is a line for when people start saying things about Jews. And when they start saying things about other special interest groups, I got an email probably 10, 12 years ago from my marketing department head saying, listing microaggressions, including words that might question someone's gender accidentally, microaggressions. And they listed all these different things about body shaming and all sorts of things, and saying that you could be ultimately, this could lead to disciplinary action and you could be dismissed. When I was at UCLA, there was something called the emergency student loan. And with your student ID, you could get $50, no questions asked. You had to pay it back in 30 days. I did it twice. One of the times on day 31, I hadn't paid it back. They sent me a notice saying you are conditionally suspended from UCLA. I got less than a 2.0 on several semesters. They said, if you get less than a 2.0 this semester, we're kicking you out of school. So universities kick people out of school and suspend them all the time. But we're having all this hand-wringing over a group of students and sometimes non-students who say pretty vile things, make other students feel unsafe, and all of a sudden we've decided that they shouldn't be suspended. So I find what is going on another set of double standards around Israel and Jews. I just think that if any other special interest group was the subject of this type of hate speech, we would be having a different response on campus. I think that campuses have decided that they're for social engineering and a political orthodoxy instead of centers of excellence. And I think you give students a wide berth. I think you got to be forgiving of them. But there's no room for making any special interest group feel vulnerable or unsafe. And it's a tough needle to thread. I sympathize with university leadership. But I'm fine picking a line, but I want the line to apply to everybody. I just don't think, look, if the same, replace black or replace people talking about this, about gays, same behavior, same aggressiveness, same harassment, I think we'd send in the fucking National Guard. I don't think we'd be having this existential discussion around First Amendment. So I see a double standard. I see a double standard across everything Israel right now. I don't think, you know, I think at the end of the day, we just hold Israel and Jews to a different standard, and the people who say things about Israel and Jews, we hold them to a lower standard. I think this is another example of that. I think it's a difficult situation. I think students should be able to say stupid shit and be forgiven. But I think there needs to be sharp relief that the moment free speech becomes hate speech, it shouldn't be tolerated against any special interest group.
Do you think it's going to change?
Yeah, I do. I think we're having an important conversation. I mean, if you think about DEI, I think it's probably going to be disassembled at universities because it started from a good place. 60 years ago, there were 12 black people at Princeton, Yale, and Harvard combined. 12. Fast forward to today, 51% of Harvard's freshman class is non-white. That's a victory. That's great. But when you look a little further, it gets more upsetting, and that is 70% of those non-whites come from dual income, above average income households. So when you let in the Indian son of a private equity billionaire, is that diversity? And over time, what DEI has evolved to is the following. Okay, non-whites have been treated like crap in this country. They need a hand up. We can all get on board with that. Well, Asians, we intern Japanese in concentration camps, basically. Okay, they need a hand up. Women go to 73 cents on the dollar when they decide to have kids. Well, they deserve advantage. It was 40 years ago. And slowly but surely, we decided that basically every population but straight white males deserved advantage. And under the age of 18, the number of straight white males makes up 23% of our population. So when you advocate for empathy, additional resources, additional protection for 77% of the population, you're not advantaging them. You're disadvantaging the 23%. And it's created a lot of agita on campus. And so the question is, how can we come together? And my view is that we need affirmative action. And it should be based on color, but the color should be green. You would rather be born non-white today. You would rather be born gay than born poor. And that's a sign of something wonderful in our society, that we've recognized that some people were born with wins in their faces and they need advantage. But now the kids that face the greatest disadvantage in America are kids born poor. And so I think we should have affirmative action, but it should be what the University of California did 26 years ago. 26 years ago, people don't talk about this. Actually, 27. In 1997, the University of California, the greatest public school system in the world, said, we're going to do away with race-based affirmative action, and we're going to have an adversity score. And by the way, we get to mostly the same place, because one of the unfortunate things about our country is that Black and Latino households still have much less wealth than white households. But if you're the son, if you're the daughter of someone killing it, and you have money, whether you're gay, whether your parents are non-white, whether you're non-white, you're probably going to be okay. It's the poor kids that are having the biggest problems. So I believe in affirmative action. I just don't think it should be based on anything visible now. I think it causes more problems than it solves. I've seen firsthand that any place that has a DEI department is usually already one of the most diverse and inclusive places in the world. It's like building fire stations in the Atlantic. And at universities, we have gotten so out of control with this arrogance and self-aggrandizement that we can teach kids how to be more ethical, that we should be teaching leadership, ethics, sustainability, DEI, that what's happened is at MIT, for every 11 people that work at MIT, only one teaches. And the result is tuition has skyrocketed. So my question is, take all of these well-meaning departments and ask yourself, what would be better for society? Either these departments or taking all of that money and expanding freshman seats. And the argument over who gets in is so emotionally charged because it's a misdirect. The argument shouldn't be who gets in, but how many. When Harvard sits on an endowment that's the GDP of Costa Rica and they only let in the freshman class is what a Starbucks does in a day, well, who cares? Trying to manicure and calibrate the exact right mix, that misses the point. We need more trans kids in college. We need more Black kids. We need more poor kids. We need more white kids from red states. We just need more instead of focusing on their ethnicity, their sexual orientation. I think we have enough progress to say who really needs help in America today. And I think that answer is money. I think DEI is a gigantic, expensive infrastructure where people invent, you know, We invent departments where there's no accountability. How do you measure leadership? How do you measure ethics? I can't get my 13-year-old to make his bed, but I'm going to teach a 28-year-old how to be more ethical. Here's an idea. Teach him accounting. Teach him biology. Go back to be a center of excellence and give them the skills and the currency so they can support their families economically. They can add value. They become loving, generous partners and mates. And stop this arrogance and this bullshit where we've decided we're societal engineers. I think we've become so bloated, so expensive. You know what was great? The greatest diversity at UCLA was 76. They let in 76% of their applicants. So we didn't have these emotional arguments over who gets in or who gets in. Everybody gets in. You get a job. That's where higher ed has morphed from the place that lifts up people to this attempt to create a super class of billionaires by identifying freakishly remarkable kids or rich kids. That's not what America's about. So I think the DEI conversation is a sideshow. Let's take all of that money, all of those resources, let's expand freshman class size and just let in more kids. But visible affirmative action based on visible characteristics, I think it's outdated and I think causes more problems than it solves.
You know, one of the things I really admire about you, Scott, is you have become a role model for men. I know my producer, Matt, he loves your content as well. You put out amazing content for men. You mentioned earlier you're writing a book on masculinity.
Yeah.
Can you share more and more about the work that you're doing about, masculinity? Because there's a lot of content out there targeted toward men that is not you're like the antithesis of that content. Can you just talk about that and like the importance of economically viable, strong, capable men?
Thanks for your generous words. Look, if you look globally, the cohort that has ascended the fastest over the last several decades is women. They've doubled the number of elected positions in parliaments. There are more women now globally seeking tertiary educational attainment than men. This is wonderful. We should do nothing to get in the way of that. In the U.S., the cohort that has fallen the fastest is young men. In the next 5 years, we may have almost 2-to-1 female to male college grads. Men kill themselves at 4 times the rate. They're addicted at 3 times the rate. They're incarcerated at 12 times the rate. 70% of the homeless are male. 70% of opioid addicts are males. And there's a total lack of empathy because of the advantage I reaped. So 18-year-old men, 22-year-old men, 30-year-old men are paying the price for my advantage. And if you look at the statistics, it doesn't bear out that they are advantaged. In urban centers, single women are now making more money than single men. More single women own homes than single men. And I'm not suggesting we should do anything to get in the way of progress of women, but we've decided that any male features or attributes are toxic. We have dating apps where, quite frankly, young men get shut out of the market unless they're the top 10%. Women have a finer filter for mating than men. And online, if you have 50 men and 50 women, 46 of the women will show all of their attention to just 4 of the men. So men feel like they have absolutely, they're rejected in online dating. And when you don't meet in person, you can't show body language. You can't show kindness. You can't show humor. You can't show pheromones. All the game that guys like me had that didn't have money and didn't, you know, weren't handsome, all of that game goes out the window. There's no chance to find a mate. A lot of the middle class on-ramps to a good living have been outsourced because a lot of manufacturing jobs have gone away. So who do you have? You have a group of young men who can't find jobs, can't find mates, and they have the deepest resource, most talented companies in the world telling them, you don't need friends. Go on Discord and Reddit. You don't need to go through the establish the skills and the humiliation and endure the rejection of trying to find a romantic or sexual partner. Just go on YouPorn. Oh, you can't find a job. You don't want the hard work of getting discipline and finding out a way to make a living and getting out of the house and making contacts and enduring again the rejection. No problem. You can trade crypto or stocks on Coinbase or Robinhood. So we're taking a group of young men and convincing them at their most vulnerable moment that they can replace life with an algorithm and a screen. And the reality is that men are much, if you look at, I mean, there's so many factors stacked against men. We have the second most single family, single parent families in the world behind Sweden. And what it ends up is that when girls are in single parent homes, 92% of the time we mean a single mother, they have the similar outcomes, same levels of college attendance, income. Men come off the tracks. The moment they no longer have a male role model, they're dramatically more likely to kill themselves or be incarcerated. And we have an entire generation of men, you know, boys that have no men in their lives. Dad's gone. Teachers, there's more female fighter pilots per capita than male kindergarten teachers. 70 to 80% of teachers are women. You have an entire generation of men that are never exposed to other men. And then they find that they have no mating opportunities. They don't develop economic skills and they go into a downward spiral. And if any special interest group in America was committing suicide at 4 times the rate of the control group, we'd move in with social programs. We'd try and figure out what's going on with them. But young men, there's a lack of empathy. And what I would suggest is that empathy is not a zero-sum game. Civil rights didn't hurt white people. Gay marriage didn't hurt heteronormative marriage. It enhanced both those things. So who wants more economically and emotionally viable young men? Women. Because women, we'd never have an honest conversation around this shit. Women mate socioeconomically, horizontally, and up. They're worried about protecting their children. It's an instinct, and I have data that can show this. Men mate socioeconomically, horizontally, and down. The problem is the pool of men who are horizontal and up is shrinking. Men just aren't viable. How many times have you met a woman who's attractive, got her shit together, is impressive, high character, and she says, I can't find a guy to date. Yeah, she can. She just can't find any guy she wants to date. Mm-hmm. So we need to create a new class of viable, economically strong men. And I say lean into your masculinity. Masculinity is being strong, work out, be fit. It's having a plan. It's being focused on economics. It's being in the agency of service and protecting others. I think these are wonderful attributes of masculinity. And by the way, they're not sequestered to people born as men. A lot of women demonstrate tremendous masculinity. A lot of men demonstrate really wonderful feminine qualities. But to categorize masculinity as some sort of evil or something that's wrong with you, you're basically saying to 50% of the population that can lean into that really easily and is predisposed to these feelings of paternal, of aggressive. When Russian troops come pouring over the border in Ukraine, you want some of that big dick energy. You want cops and firemen that are ridiculously fucking strong. You want men who feel protective about their kids. You know, we need masculinity is a wonderful thing. And we've decided to tell kids, basically, the far right thinks masculinity is weirdness. Get a Bugatti, trade crypto, and be mean to immigrants and think of women as property. And then the far left, masculinity is act more like a woman. There's got to be something other than that. We celebrate femininity. It's wonderful. we need to start celebrating masculinity. And because parents and men themselves saw how difficult it was for young men and that no one was addressing it, there was a void. And into that void slipped really unproductive voices. And these voices start off strong. Be fit, be action-oriented, right? Take control of your life. And then it comes off the rails. Don't let your girlfriend go out with her friends. Start using words like bitch and start talking about women like they're property. And all you need to do is go to my crypto universe, university, and start telling women to be in their place and treat women like property. It comes off the rails. And so there needs to be a new aspirational vision of masculinity that says, testosterone is wonderful. Being big and strong is wonderful. Being risk aggressive is wonderful. The Carnegie Foundation gives out awards each year to people who risk their lives in random situations to save other strangers. It's literally rushing into a burning car, burning building. People who see the opportunity to help a stranger while risking their own physical safety. They gave out 81 awards last year, 77 were to men. Men are more risk aggressive. Men on the whole make better combat soldiers because women are more thoughtful. A guy will rush out to the middle of the field and save his comrades. A woman goes, is that a smart idea? Are more of us going to end up dead doing that? And by the way, you need both. You need the most productive households have someone who is risk aggressive and a big visionary. And sometimes that can be the woman. And someone who says, no, don't be stupid. We're going to do the X, Y, and Z. Let's calm that shit down. That chocolate and peanut butter is the basis of a productive household. And typically, people born as men have an easier time leaning into one set of attributes, and people born as women have an easier time leaning into another set of attributes. So I'm suggesting both have value and to lean into it. And the people I get the most support from, hands down, are mothers. And it goes something like this. I have 3 kids, 2 daughters, 1 son. One daughter's at Penn, the other daughter's in PR in Chicago, they're killing it. And my son is in the basement playing video games and vaping. So do we want, we can't have a successful society unless we have a generation of successful men. And what do you have? You have loneliness. Women are dating older now. 1 in 3 men under the age of 30 has a girlfriend. 2 in 3 women under the age of 30 have a boyfriend because they're dating older. Mm-hmm. And the result is there's fewer kids. The number of 30 to 34-year-olds that have at least one kid 40 years ago was 60%. It's dove to 27% because there aren't enough economically and emotionally viable men. And it starts very early, and I realize there's a word salad. But it ends up that girls are emotionally and mentally stronger, and boys are physically stronger. And this is a scary stat. When a boy and a girl are sexually molested, at the age of 15, the boy who's sexually molested is 10 times more likely to kill himself later in life. 10 times more likely. And that's not to say that either crime is any less heinous, but it ends up that girls are stronger emotionally and mentally. And you have a series of boys who don't have opportunity, feel shut out of the mating market, and also don't have any men in their lives. And so I would say I would like to move to some sort of solution or action. I think the ultimate expression of masculinity is to get involved in the life of a child that isn't yours, right? And because Michael Jackson and the Catholic Church have fucked it up for all of us, you're seen as a weirdo if you decide to take an interest in a 15-year-old boy's life. There is nothing more important. There's nothing America needs more right now. There's no greater expression of masculinity. I worry that there's just a ton of young men who have no men in their lives. And that is, if you reverse engineer all of this to a single point of failure, it's when they lose a male role model. It's a jet lag speaking. I'm getting emotional.
I'm so grateful for you. And you're a tremendous role model to so many. And I appreciate the vulnerability as well. And it's been an absolute honor and pleasure having you on. And I want to give you the final couple minutes before we have our hard stop here. And to leave the audience with some parting thoughts, some things to think about. And it can be anything that comes to mind.
Oh, look, I think just in terms of, I'll move it back to my book. I think wealth is a full person project. I think the advice I would have for people is when they're successful to recognize a lot of your success is not your fault, that you need to be humble. You're never more vulnerable to a big mistake than after you have a big win. Like you have a great year in the markets, you start believing you're a great investor, you kill it at work, you start thinking, oh, you're a baller. Be humble, be kind, recognize a lot of your success and all your fault, but also forgive yourself. If you have a relationship that doesn't work out, if you have a stock that goes down, if you get fired, realize some of it is you, but most of it is the market. And that the key to success is to mourn and move on. That life isn't about what happens to you. It's about how you respond to what happens to you. And as someone who has finally reached a level of success, I've had companies go Chapter 11. I've been divorced. There's been moments in my life where I thought, I'm never going to make money again. I've been excommunicated from the corporate world. I'm never going to find somebody I can share my life with. And both of those things worked out for me. So the key is the ability to mourn and move on, to be around people who lift you up, to find means, whether it's meditation, whether it's working out, such that you can look in the mirror every day and say, I am the answer to a company's problems, and I can make someone's life wonderful. That's the key, is your ability to mourn and to move on.
Scott, you are truly such a good human, a great man.
Julia.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time and being so generous with all your ideas, your wisdom, your knowledge. And everyone, please go pick up a book of Scott's new book, The Algebra of Wealth. Thank you again, Scott Galloway.
Thank you, Julia. Congrats on all your success.
Thank you.